reported start time of that fire.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up.
Well, good afternoon, friends. Good afternoon, friends and listeners. Hope one and the same. You're listening now to the Lawyers Guild Show here in Los Angeles. I'm Jim Lafferty, along with my co-host, Maria Hall. And hi, Maria, how are you doing?
Hi, Jim. Well, luckily, I'm safe from the wildfires anyway, but yeah, really grieving with so many people who are just confused right now a little panicked. And we're all just trying to take it a day at a time and be there for our friends who have lost their property.
And indeed we are. And a little bit later, we'll announce some ways in which KPFK can help. If you're wondering what the devil is going on and how you can get some help, we'll talk about that in the course of the show today. But give our listeners a sense of what our programmatic segments are going to be today.
Yes. Well, yeah, as LA deals with this crisis, we have other crises across our great country. So in our first half hour, we'll be joined by constitutional law scholar Stephen Rohde to talk about the United States Supreme Court, such as judicial ethics, recent decisions, and frankly, whether the court is poised to become special counsel for the Republican Party. And then in our second half hour, we'll be joined by attorney Jaime Jimenez for a briefing on Trump's plan to dismantle the federal workforce. We'll find out how labor unions are standing by, ready to defend the rights and livelihoods of federal workers, who, let's not forget, are vital to maintaining our national security, our public health and safety, and our organized system of government.
Oh, well, dear me, it's a lot to cover. Let's get right to it. We'll start with those constitutional questions in the Supreme Court. On January, and I have a bit of a fog still living in my throat, but he's behaving himself, I think. On January 14th of this year, ProPublica published an article entitled, quote, Clarence Thomas's 38 Vacations, the Other Billionaires Who Have Treated the Supreme Court Justice to Luxury Travel, close quote. That article provides details about, various billionaires allowing Thomas and his wife to have, as the article puts it, and I quote, enjoyed a lifestyle most Americans can only imagine, close quote. Indeed, Justice Thomas has been the recipient of more than just fancy vacations and travel. It's now been reported that Justice Thomas has accepted nearly $4.2 million worth of gifts and benefits over two decades on the court. And that, friends, is a total nearly 10 times the value of all gifts received by his fellow justices during that same period of time. Well, the public scandal over Thomas's acceptance of 38 luxury vacations together with millions of dollars of other benefits give rise, of course, to the call for the U.S. Supreme Court justices, to be accountable to a code of ethics as are other judges. Congress could, but has not, adopted a code of justice for the justice. And so far, the only code that exists is one they've now created to police themselves by. But it has precious little teeth. It consists principally of five basic canons, of which include, relevant to our discussion today, include the principle that as a justice should uphold the integrity and independence of the judiciary. A justice should avoid impropriety and the appearance of impropriety in all activities, and a justice should be performing the duties of office fairly, impartially, and diligently. But it provides, as I say, no effective manner of enforcement. So we keep learning of new gifts received by Thomas, gifts like those prior gifts that clearly raise critically important issues of Thomas's possible conflicts of interest and what would seem to violate at least those three canons in the court's code of ethics that I've cited. In addition to that matter, though, of lack of enforcement of the ethical conduct of Supreme Court justices, we'll also ask our guest today why he claims the court in recent years has effectively become, and again, I quote, special counsel to the Republican Party, close quote, which is hell-bent on reversing many of the rulings of the Earl Warren-led Supreme Court of 60 more years have passed. Of course, to talk to us about these matters today, we've invited back to the show our go-to expert on all matters constitutional and legal, really, Mr. Steve Rohde. Mr. Rohde is a civil rights activist, author, constitutional scholar. He currently serves as chair of the Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace, which has formed in the wake of 9/11 for the purpose of organizing faith-based communities to call for an end to war and violence. He's also a past president of the ACLU Foundation of Southern California, past chair of Death Penalty Focus and Bend the Arc, which is a Jewish partnership for justice. Despite that long list of affiliations, today Steve Rohde is not speaking on behalf of any of them, just on behalf of himself. And we welcome you back, Steve, to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thank you, Jim and Maria. It's a pleasure to be with you because these sessions always allow me to gather my thoughts and focus on the problems that face us. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Steve. There are codes of ethics covering other members of the judiciary, but not the Supreme Court, as I say, save for the one they've drawn up for themselves, and it appears to have no real enforcement. I mean, given the months and that we've known now, really years, of billions of dollars of gifts given to Justice Thomas, and there's been a few other justices that have gotten some gifts as well, but nothing like this. And they've been given to him by very rich people, have they not, whose interests are often rewarded or not by Supreme Court decisions in which Justice Thomas has participated. I mean, he doesn't tend to recuse himself, does he? Has he not therefore violated some of the terms of the court's own code of conduct by not recusing himself in certain cases?
I think so. And my theme today, kind of an overall theme, this notion of the current Supreme Court being special counsel to the Republican Party, is bookended by what we're talking about. At the front end are these corrupt conflicts of interest that Justice Thomas and even to some extent Samuel Alito are involved in. It is stunning. Stop anyone on the street and ask if there is an enforceable code of ethics that applies to judges, and they would be right, except for the United States Supreme Court. Literally, there is no body, there is no judicial council, there is no entity that polices and monitors the ethics of the justices of the U.S. Supreme Court and their conflicts of interest. And it has reached an exponential a degree of conflicts when it comes to Justice Clarence Thomas. You highlighted many of his grievous conflicts of interest, but I've got a few more. Harlan Crow gave Thomas a $19,000 valued Bible previously owned by Frederick Douglass. Thomas received a $15,000 bust of Abraham Lincoln from the American Enterprise Institute, where Crow serves as a trustee. Crow made a donation to a library in Thomas's hometown. He paid the private school tuition of Thomas's grandnephew, whom the Thomases had taken in. Crow bought Thomas's childhood home and spent money developing it and improving it while Thomas's elderly mother lived there. And Crow donated $100,000 for a portrait of Thomas at Yale Law School and helped finance a documentary about Thomas's life. And actually, these are only a portion of the grievous conflicts of interest that Thomas has engaged in, because Crow finances litigation, amicus briefs, and direct briefs in the Supreme Court in cases Thomas decides. And then we shouldn't overlook that most ethical rules includes members of a judge's family. And Gina Thomas, Clarence Thomas's wife, formed a conservative group, raised $600,000 to file amicus briefs in a case, and Thomas did not recuse himself. She publicly criticized the January 6th commission when Trump failed to turn over records to that committee. The Supreme Court entirely ruled in favor of Congress, but there was one justice who dissented from that ruling and ruled in favor of Trump, and that was Clarence Thomas. Leonard Leo, some of your listeners have been tracking, he's the leader of the Federalist Society. He told Kellyanne Conway to give Jenny Thomas another $25,000 through a nonprofit group he advises, which then filed an amicus brief in the United States Supreme Court. And if we have signs of guilt, he told Conway to conceal the payment. No mention of Jenny, of course, he said, the Washington Post reported. Now, all of this is a direct conflict, but it also is a conflict of the rules regarding the disclosure of financial information. There's the Ethics in Government Act. Now, that act does apply to Thomas, and he has consistently violated over the years. Then he comes up with a mea culpa to, oh, I overlooked that $15,000 payment. And he has, and the DOJ has the power to file civil actions for a failure to disclose. And yet, in the last week of the Biden administration, the DOJ has never undertaken the civil action they could have brought against Justice Thomas. So that is just scratching the surface. Chief Justice Roberts is only too willing to launch an investigation. If you remember that the Dobbs opinion overturning Roe v. Wade was leaked to the press. Oh, boy, Thomas launched an investigation on that, but he's never launched an investigation on Clarence Thomas.
Well, Stephen Rohde, given the apparent lack of any enforcement of even its own code of conduct, which is, I understand, very liberal, even compared to superior court judges who are not allowed to take gifts from their friends even. What do you believe should be done? The public's confidence in the court is already so low. In fact, its recent approval rating is less than 50%, and that's 23% lower than it was in August 2020. So what do you recommend as a solution?
Well, I've already hinted at one, and that's that the DOJ could have taken civil action in this case and didn't. Look, we do have impeachment. Federal judges can be impeached. There was one attempt decades or centuries ago against a Supreme Court justice that failed. The problem, and we'll expand on this in a moment, is the lock currently that the Republican Party has on the Senate, so you cannot get the necessary two-thirds vote to impeach. There were two attempts to impeach Trump, of course. So even if an attempt had been made to impeach Clarence Thomas, that would have failed. I think it's high time we take a look at term limits on the U.S. Supreme Court, as well as, frankly, an idea that I did not warm to some years ago, which is to expand the court. The Constitution does not set the number of justices. It has swung from 6 justices to 11 justices over its history. We currently have 9 justices. I do think that Jim put his finger on at least 3 of the unenforceable canons that the Supreme Court adopted for itself: uphold integrity and independence of the judiciary, avoid impropriety or the appearance of impropriety, and perform duties impartially. I wanted to remind listeners that may go back as long as I do that in 1969, Abe Fortas, a prominent lawyer and Supreme Court justice, was forced off the court because he took a $20,000 fee from a foundation that was then currently under investigation for securities fraud. $20,000. And Abe Fortas, he gave the money back. But the Democrats in that case, and he was a Democratic appointee, it was the Democrats who stood on the principles of conflicts of interest and insisted on his resignation. Those are the old times. We're in the new times. I think it's going to take political organizing and remembering that Supreme Court justices are created out of our political system. We're going to have to weather that for four more years. And I must say, I fear that Thomas may resign in a few years, not because of his scandals, but to give Donald Trump a chance to appoint a younger Clarence Thomas.
Indeed, that is a fear. Well, Steve, while you were here today, as Maria announced at the top of the show, we want to ask you about another aspect of what's going on. It has been for some years now at the Supreme Court, although it seems to be accelerating in recent times. It's been argued that the court has become nothing more, and you put it this way yourself, nothing more than special counsel to the Republican Party, operating as though they have a client and it's the Republican Party, if you will, going out of its way to reverse rulings and reject the reasoning of the Earl Warren Supreme Court back in the 60s and such. For example, of course, the highly recognized example of that would be in 2022 when the six-member conservative majority of the court in Dobbs versus Jackson overturned Roe v. Wade. Now, Roe v. Wade, for almost 50 years, guaranteed a constitutional right to reproductive freedom. The court used the theory of originalism to overturn it. So we hear that term bandied about a bit. The judges just love to bandy it about. For our audience's sake, for those of us who haven't gone to law school and what have you, what the devil is originalism anyway? And what role does it play in the Trump presidency? Does this judicial theory and cases like the Dobbs decision pose a real threat to our constitutional democracy?
Yes, and it does, and it's serious. Originalism is a legal theory invented in the 1980s by a group of law professors, Robert Bork, if you remember him, well as the Federalist Society. And I call originalism the judicial analog of make America great again. In other words, let's go back to an older time when there was white male hegemony over America. Do you know that in 1937, the court upheld a tax on women who chose to vote? In 1948, the court upheld a prohibition against women serving as bartenders. Ronald Reagan spoke of traditional family values as a code for going back to those times. But it's not just old news. J.D. Vance spoke of a bunch of childless cat ladies who are miserable. And most recently in 2020, Mark Robinson was a candidate, a Republican candidate for lieutenant governor in North Carolina. He said, I absolutely want to go back to the America where women couldn't vote because that was when the Republican Party had a better reputation. So my theme today is that the court is now using a checklist to go through the Republican platform and to achieve in the court what Republicans have not been able to achieve, even having taken over the presidency. They're threatening to move on from abortion to birth control to mifepristone, the medicated abortion product. They are pushing fatal personhood. After Dobbs, 18 states banned abortion. 15 of those have no exception for rape or incest. So it is a constant and planned campaign to use originalism, this notion that the Constitution was frozen in its meaning in 1789, and to use that to extract a whole series of reversals in the kinds of constitutional rights that Americans now take for granted.
Well, Stephen Rohde, critics accuse the conservative Supreme Court of following the Republican political platform in the areas of marriage equality, voting rights, economic inequality, and of course, loosening or eliminating environmental and other regulations adopted by Congress. What has the Supreme Court done in these important areas?
Well, let's go on speed dial to go through those areas. Let's remember that in 2015, in a 5-4 decision in Obergefell, the court held that state laws prohibiting same-sex marriages were unconstitutional. But the majority included Justices Kennedy and Ginsburg. They are gone, and that 5-4 court has now become a 6-3 conservative court. The Republican justices are chipping away at these rights. In a case in 2023 called 303 Creative, they held that states cannot prohibit a wedding website designer from discriminating against weddings that celebrated same-sex weddings. And they did it on my beloved First Amendment by saying the website designer was engaged in expressive activity. You know, today, 60 to 70% of Americans support marriage equality. So what the right wing has done is portray themselves as an oppressed minority. The religious and social conservatives are a minority. So their First Amendment rights to express opposition to marriage equality must be protected, thereby excusing them from anti-discrimination laws. And that's the kind of theory the Republican Party is using. When you get to voting rights, in 2013, in a 5-4 conservative decision, the court struck down the Voting Rights Act's pre-clearance provisions, where historically slave states and states that had discriminated had to have a pre-clearance by the Justice Department of any major changes in their voting plans and prospects. Now, that was upheld. The Voting Rights Act has been upheld by Democrat and Republican presidents for years. But in 2013, in Shelby County, the conservative Supreme Court struck it down. They created a judicial invention, the doctrine of the equality of the states. All states must be equal, despite the history of certain southern states in discriminating. And following that case, the states have imposed voting restrictions, which have had the effect of suppressing the black vote. When it comes to economic equality, in the Janus case in 2018, 5-4, they struck down the collection of union dues from all employees, union or non-union, even though all employees benefited from the collective bargaining contracts that had been negotiated by the union. And in Cedar Point, they struck down a law allowing union organizers to talk to farm workers at certain times on certain days. I'm just highlighting each of these examples. Yeah. And if the final one is the deregulation, Republicans hate government regulations, which give us cleaner air and cleaner water. And for 40 years in the court, they followed the Chevron Doctrine. It's a case from 1984. It was a 6-3 decision. Three of the justices did not participate. And it said the court should defer to government agencies who have special expertise in interpreting the laws in which Congress delegated them authority. That was the law of the land for almost 40 years. And in 2022, in a 6-3 decision in West Virginia versus EPA, this conservative court invalidated the EPA's clean power plan designed to reduce pollution from power plants. Where did they find the right to do that? Not in the Constitution. They invented the major questions doctrine, which had never existed before and never been used by the court. It said the court is in a better position than administrative agencies to understand the expertise needed to decide these important questions. The Supreme Court has become a super legislature, and this is just a glancing tip of the iceberg about how this court invents judicial notions then to achieve in the court what they're not achieving in Congress and elsewhere to advance the Republican agenda.
And I'm thinking, Steve, as well, last July, in Trump v. United States, of course, by another 6-3 vote, the court granted Trump absolute immunity from criminal liability for anything that he, the president, does in carrying out his quote-unquote official duties. Now that Trump is returning to the White House in less than a week, are you not concerned that Trump will use this immunity decision to break the law and violate the rights of Americans with rather assured immunity?
Being concerned doesn't begin to describe how worried I am about this. Next week, we will launch into Trump's second term. And it's not a get out of jail free card. He doesn't go to jail. He is going to be able, under the aptly named Trump versus the United States decision, to have absolute, unquestioned criminal immunity for any act he takes which is deemed to be within his, quote, official duties. He is threatening to use the Insurrection Act to call up military troops to suppress protests. He has threatened to go after his political enemies. He has created an agenda, much of it borrowed from the Project 2025 program. So whatever he was able to achieve, whatever mischief he achieved in his first 4 years, he now goes into office wrapped in a doctrine of immunity. Now, the Supreme Court is supposed to love the text of the Constitution and originalism. The Constitution does not grant the president immunity from anything. This six-member court invented presidential immunity out of thin air. It is now the law of the land, and it arms Trump with a powerful insulation from the kinds of criminal laws that apply to you and me. He is truly above the law, and I shudder to think what we're in for in these next 4 years. We are going to have to politically organize. We are going to have to face the midterm elections. We are going to have to organize within the electoral system and outside of the electoral system to resist the onslaught of illegality that I think we're about to see.
Indeed. Thank you, Steve. Yeah.
Constitutional law scholar Stephen Rohde, we are running out of time, but just give us your last thoughts and please remind listeners how to follow your great work.
Well, one of my last thoughts is not, today I don't think is a fun drive, but KPFK is an independent voice. This is where you hear programs like this and where I get to be invited as a guest. So we've got to support KPFK. We got to support independent media. We've got to support organizations that are speaking truth to power. For myself, you can find my writings online. I write for Truth Dig and the LA Progressive and a variety of other publications, and it's easy to find those. I, for one, am going to keep speaking up, and anytime you invite me back, you know I'll be here.
Thank you, Steve, as always, for being with us today and in a very straightforward and understandable way. One doesn't have to go to law school to understand your brilliance and the way that you go about explaining these otherwise complicated cases. So we thank you. Thank you again for doing that. We often hear from our listeners about how much they appreciate it, and they appreciate hearing about complex legal matters in a way that not only do they understand, but often inspires them to take the kind of action you're calling for, that Maria and I call for, that we indeed our theme song calls for, about standing up for your rights. So we're going to say thank you again, Steve, for being with us today. We're going to take a brief station ID break now, and then we're going to be right back with you with another critically important topic of the day.
The benefits of donating your used vehicle to KPFK include funding new and existing programming, as well as increasing community awareness. You also benefit by being able to reduce your taxable income. There's no need to deal with the hassles of selling it, and you support public radio in the process. To donate your vehicle, please call 877-KPFK-AUTO. That's 877-KPFK-AUTO.
Well, and we are back with another quick and a short ID break. We always appreciate that. You're still listening to the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm Jim Lafferty, along with my co-host, Maria Hall. And we're about to get into the topic of public employees and what Trump intends to do to those, untold numbers of public employees that make this country function every day, that keep this government running, and do so in a way in which they are not beholden to somebody who appointed them to some cushy job, which, of course, is, I suspect, what Trump has in mind. Before we do that, though, let me just quickly announce that we here at KPFK, of course, as I think Maria said at the top of the show, are truly sad and distressed about what has happened to so many of our sisters and brothers. They've lost their homes. They've lost their livelihoods. They've lost their lives, for goodness sake. And we try to do what we can here at the station by keeping you posted on what is going on so that you have truthful and accurate information. In that regard, you can get accurate and current fire evacuation orders and warnings at something called, we checked this out, this one is a good one for you, friends, watchduty.com. Just WATCHDUTY, watchduty.com. You can use the free Watch Duty phone app if you want to get that. You can go to a link in the website where you'll find more resources listed. And, of course, you also can find a lot of these resources listed on the KPFK's homepage at kpfk.org. So feel free to check out watchduty.com. You can believe what it says there about whether you're in danger, whether your friends or family are in danger, and other things you need to know during this truly tying time in the history of Los Angeles. Well, now, Maria Hall, please introduce our next guest who's already waiting what we euphemistically call the, I guess I should call it the cloud room or something. They're here on the internet where there's no green room here. But introduce our guest and let's get right to it.
Sure. And if I can make a friendly amendment, it's actually watchduty.org.
Oh, I'm sorry. See, the copy that was sent to me says watchduty.com.
Well, I know.
That's all right. Try it either way, friends. One of them will get there.
Yeah, I think you can find it. It's pretty big, but yes. So as I said, as I did mention at the top of the hour, we are grieving along with everyone and still worried about the future of Los Angeles. But in the meantime, that doesn't stop the rest of the country's crises as well. So on that note, last month, writer Dave Jameson wrote the following about Donald Trump in HuffPost, quote, "As the incoming boss of the federal workforce, President-elect Donald Trump has made clear his disdain for civil servants. He's called them crooked and dishonest people who are destroying the country. He's equated them with the conspiracy theorists, deep state, and he's promised to fire a lot of them after he assumes office, end quote. In addition, Trump has made clear his disdain for federal unions and has threatened even to dismantle them altogether. Now remember, the 2 to 3 million federal workers in the U.S. carry important responsibilities, including safeguarding our public health and safety and our national security. They are often unseen, keeping the government functioning in an orderly manner from behind the scenes. What's at stake for federal workers and for our national security and safety if the Trump administration follows through with plans to gut federal employee protections and jobs? Well, to talk with us today about this critical issue is attorney Jaime Jimenez. Jaime is a graduate of Loyola Law School here in Los Angeles, and he's been giving briefings on the likely executive orders that may be enacted in the coming weeks or months that will significantly impact the federal workforce and therefore all of us. Attorney Jaime Jimenez, welcome to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Maria, thank you for having me. Jim, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to talk about this unpleasant topic, which affects more people than we take it as fact.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you're here to help get the word out. So to start off, to help us frame this discussion, can you give us just a summary of who federal workers are, what kinds of jobs they do, and what percentage of the American labor force do they represent?
Yes, you mentioned it earlier. There are between 2 to 3 million workers, federal workers in the United States. Now, this is 1.87% of the working public. So it, as numbers go, they are the largest employer of individuals in the United States. These jobs cover everything. They cover aviation, highways, TSA, IRS, Social Security Administration, accountants, lawyers, secretaries, telecommunication, financial monitoring, food, energy, trade, housing, which is very important here in Los Angeles. Everything that the government touches, everything that has an administration associated with it, is a federal employee that is frankly going to feel the brunt of these executive orders that have previously been enacted and have been threatened to be enacted very quickly after inauguration.
I'm wondering, you know, as well, how these workers are currently protected as public employees. Are they unionized? Are they under some federal statutes that say that, you know, they can't be willy-nilly fired, which is, of course, what Trump wants to do. He signaled, has he not, that he wants to chip away at the rights that they have, that organized workers that are under certain protections of unions and otherwise have, he wants to chip away at that. That's what bothers him, is it not? He can't simply put his cronies in to run these departments.
Yeah, just to continue that, his cronies, frankly, serve at the pleasure of the president. So heads of departments, heads of say, the Department of the Army, the Navy, transportation, they serve at the pleasure of the president. He can fire them when and if he decides he wants to. Other federal employees, sub-cabinet level, to the essentially the level that does not have to be Senate confirmed, those do not serve at the pleasure of the president. And I believe that's part of the issue. Part of what causes such a big rift with President Trump is the fact that federal employees know what kind of work they do. They don't consider themselves to be the bane of society that Trump attempts to paint them as. They are hardworking individuals that are, their jobs are to protect most of the aspects that come, that people come into contact with. Being able to drive on a road, there's someone that essentially makes sure that there's enough funding to make sure that the potholes get fixed or what have you. For TSA, that there's enough people to ensure terrorists don't get through security with items that can hurt other individuals. They're there to protect and to help and to provide a service to the American public. They just happen to tone. They tend to vote Democratic because lately they haven't. Only one party has really been attacking their existence as federal employees. And really, one of the few ways that they can protect themselves, one, it is more difficult to fire a federal employee. There is processes that have to take place, but the unions that which most organizations do have, they're the ones that protect the rights. And these executive orders are stymied by these unions and these collective bargaining agreements, where agencies and unions come together and decide, these are the rules we're going to work under. These are the protections that are in place. This is what we expect in return, which is essentially any contract in existence. The issue is, these contracts do provide protection to employees so that they may do their job without having to worry about someone elected changing the full nature of their employment and, frankly, threatening their position's existence.
Well, let's talk a little bit about collective bargaining and having the union protection. Historically, unions amassed power because individual workers joined together to speak with a unified voice and therefore could match that power of the bosses. So in broad strokes, how might collective bargaining be at risk under these executive orders and the Trump administration?
You've hit the nail absolutely on the head. We have a situation where unions do protect their members in not overstepping, however, in protecting their rights, that someone wouldn't be able to be, say, disciplined or fired because of capriciousness. Someone just looking to get rid of someone else. There's processes in place that ensure if a firing does happen, it is legitimate and it is absolutely within the nature of not just law, but of the protections granted by collective bargaining. And unions tend to fight most issues simply to protect the inalienable rights that they've argued for, that they've fought for, of ensuring that their employment exists, ensuring that they're able to do their job correctly, and ensuring they have whatever is necessary for them to do their job. Unfortunately, they are under siege. And the reason we can say they are under siege as opposed to possibly, it's the Trump administration has already attacked federal sector unions in executive orders in 2018. There were three executive orders particularly. One, which is assess the negotiations and determine limits on essentially union activities within the federal sector. Another one is dealing with official time and what can be done during said official time. And the third one is streamlining the ability to fire people in a way that is unheard of in the federal sector. The idea is all of these are immediately in effect as long as an organization doesn't have an active collective bargaining agreement that's actively protecting them. So as soon as that collective bargaining agreement comes up for negotiation, those executive orders control. Now, in a vacuum, the title of them are incredible: developing efficient, effective, and cost-reducing approaches to federal sector collective bargaining, which is the first one I'll address, sounds reasonable. However, this eliminates permissive subject to bargaining. So not pay or grievance procedures, but all the items around, which would typically fall under management's right to work, typically the agencies have been able to negotiate around these because they see the benefit in working with their employees, figuring out what works best for their employees to be able to give a better product. All of those are off the table. So someone being able to negotiate, this is my job. Anything outside of that shouldn't be given to me because that is not my job, is also no longer on the table. They can be assigned something completely different than what they were hired to do simply because it's management's right to assign them work. Additionally, it limits the amount a union can negotiate. So it's not unheard of that ground rules for a collective bargaining agreement take between 4 to 6 months to negotiate. Just the ground rules before the substantive negotiation of the contract itself, which can take a year or more. This executive order limits it to 4 to 6 weeks. And then the negotiation of the contract itself is 4 to 6 months. And anyone who's negotiated anything understands that putting that kind of time limit gives one side incredible control. The organization that can wait is the one that has significantly more power. Additionally, all negotiations would have to take place in writing. There's no ability for two people to talk to each other. It's, here's my proposal. Thank you very much. Here's my counter proposal. Thank you very much. And just back and forth until you come to an agreement. The executive order also stated that if there's a delay because of union delay, or the union did not get back to the agency as quickly, the agency would likely be able to implement their rules. So it's incredible the limitations this executive order places on federal unions' ability to negotiate, the time frame to negotiate, and placing almost every ball on the court on one side, which it makes it interesting when you consider that in conjunction with the next executive order, ensuring transparency, accounting, and efficiency in taxpayer-funded union time. That makes official time, which is time that a union officer can work on union business. That could be representational duties, preparing grievances, preparing presentations for arbitration, teaching their employees what their rights are and how they can protect themselves and how, frankly, to knock it off if necessary to do their job. All of that is diminished significantly, where organizations are seeing 70 to 80 to 90% decline in the official time that they'd be allowed, which would now be 1 hour per employee per year. But because of all the limitations in the first executive order, it's assumed they wouldn't have as much to do because all negotiations, would take place at the national level. There would no longer be any local negotiations of different facilities, different offices, different buildings to be able to see what works best for them. All of that, in addition to a union no longer being able to take their dues through the payroll system, would limit the ability of the union to collect the funds necessary to protect the rights of those employees, considering those rights have also declined because of the inability to negotiate at the local level and the limitations placed on the national level. And all of that comes to the last executive order, which promoting accountability and streamlining removal procedures consistent with merit system principles, which makes it easier to fire fellow employees, and the protections and processes in place to ensure that someone is only removed from their job because of serious issues. All of those obstacles are gone. Mm-hmm. And it all creates a situation that pushes people out the door. There are numerous individuals that feel that these jobs are very similar to the immigration system, that it's not exactly to get people to get fired. It's to push people out the door that would significantly increase the cost saving that the administration would have, because they're showing all these employees decided to leave on their own. We only had to fire a certain amount, and those were necessary, and able to contract the federal workforce at that point, which serves the larger issue of reducing regulation and the ability to regulate on any number of issues across the country and across businesses that we deal with on a daily basis.
Well, all of this, is it not, Jaime, part and parcel of the fact that Trump has been very open, along with his colleague Musk, on this, that he doesn't want unions. He doesn't want unionized employees. he thinks that people on strike should be able to be fired. That's you go on strike, you get fired, which of course you can't do currently. He doesn't want to have, we talked about this earlier, federal government employees running the various departments of government, even though they know they've had the experience in how to do it. He wants that to be private so that he can control it and have influence over what it does and what it doesn't do. You've mentioned some of the rights that would be curtailed, important rights that would be curtailed. But if Trump had his way, basically there'd be no unions. That's sort of what he's on to. That's what these types of executive orders you're talking about are heading towards. What other kinds of workers' rights, if any, that you haven't had a chance to mention yet, might be curtailed? What might be the consequences of that? If, for example, he's able to so either weaken the unions, get rid of the unions for federal employees, what might be the consequence of the federal employment system becoming, in essence, a boondoggle, where somebody who works in your campaign gets a federal job, whether they know the first thing about how to run a post office or not, or how to run the tax department or not, or how to run the EPA or not, but because they contribute to your campaign, you've got a job there. Whereas some federal employee who's been doing it for the last 5, 10, whatever number of years under programs in his place that runs it efficiently. Talk to us about what we, the public, loses and what the workers lose if, in fact, this takes what I think is the big step that Trump wants to take.
Well, it has one, the largest immediate issue is going to be, it's going to have a chilling effect on any kind of asserting a right. If you assert a right, if you fight for a right that's already protected, there's the fear that you're going to create a target on yourself, because now there are individuals who are able to protect their rights, are able to claim, I worked that day, you should pay me for the day I worked, or I worked an extra 2 hours because you forced me to. I deserve to be paid overtime for that. Well, in the interest of not raising too many flags, people may begin to eat that. Excuse me. And a larger issue for me is you're pushing people with the knowledge to do the job mm-hmm. out of the job. So you're going to have significant number of individuals push into positions because they wrote a check or they spoke highly about the party in power, who not only don't have anyone to teach them how to do the job, they lack any kind of knowledge on how to get the job started. So highways may not be as kept as they could be. Airports may not be as safe as they could be because TSA isn't going to be there to watch people. The FAA may not be there to provide the funds that various airports need to maintain their airports to snuff. Mm-hmm. And everything that is touched by the American public at one point has a federal employee that's associated with that job. Mm-hmm. Going to dinner. You had the FDA look at the meat. Mm-hmm. You have the Department of Transportation looking at the highways that have the truck that delivered the food, the railway that handled the long way shipping. You have even the FTC dealing with if that company's even fairly traded. You have the FCC that's even dealing with the communications when they run your credit card. Every aspect of oversight and would be diminished because the person who knew how to do the job was forced out for someone who knew how to write a check, for someone who knew which ring to kiss. That is completely contrary to what I was raised hearing and what most people are raised hearing, that through hard work, you will find a job where you are able to provide something to society. And we have individuals who have found that job. To have them pushed out is saddening. It's heartbreaking because the people we want doing those jobs will either be frustrated in doing it or not doing them at all.
Well, unfortunately, we are running out of time, but I want to get this last question in. Attorney Jaime Jimenez, social reformer and abolitionist Frederick Douglass said, quote, "Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did and it never will," end quote. Are there groups out there, you've mentioned the unions for one, trying to resist the dismantling of federal workers' rights? And if so, what are the challenges they're facing on the ground?
Well, the unions obviously are the most vocal and visible organizations that are fighting, but you have individuals who see the inherent unfairness of the situation. You have yourself and Jim with a radio show, ensuring people are educated in the possibilities and to hear the injustices and just feel the outrage of the big guy poking the little guy without fearing any kind of repercussion. Power never concedes anything if they can help it. And there's a reason why certain people wanted power. So those people, frankly, shouldn't have it. There was a Roman general who was crowned dictator. I forget his name, but he was held as the example because as soon as he was done fighting the war he had to fight, he left the power and went back to his farm. Those are the people we want. People who don't want the power. People who just want to be of service. And unfortunately, those people are under threat by the Trump administration.
Mm-hmm. Well, we are, as Maria said, about out of time. I'm not quite sure how much time we have left, actually, at this point. Maybe Maria, you know, but from where I'm sitting, it's hard to tell.
Yeah, about 1 minute. About 1 minute, Jim.
Oh, dear.
Well, 90 seconds.
Before we let you go then, Jaime, where would you direct our listeners if they want to learn more about what you were talking about today? Are there some good websites, either union website, government unionized employee work sites? Where would they go to find out more?
If you want general information on worker empowerment, OPM, the Office of Personnel Management for the federal government, has a pretty robust site. Gives rights, how to join a union, who can join, that sort of thing. If you're interested in any particular business, financial monitoring, TSA, Social Security Administration, you may be able to just search union and that administration, and you'll be able to find any information because most federal worker unions are very vocal as to what their rights and what their protections are trying to be.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Jaime. No, thank you so much for joining us today, Jaime Jimenez. I mean, this is really a critical and important topic. Trump's talking about it rather openly, but people don't understand until they hear someone like you or until they go to the website you mentioned, just what it might mean in their daily lives, the health of their food, the health of their medicines, the health of the air they breathe. I mean, we're learning something about that here in Los Angeles now.
Yes, we are.
It is. So you better believe that what Trump has in mind, it isn't just somebody else's problem, not just those untold numbers of federal workers' problems. It's everybody's worker all over America's problem, everybody's citizen's problem, every resident's problem. So do check out those websites and be part of the movement against this development, part of the movement against getting rid of those federal protections and of all union rights, of all the union employees in our country. So much. Thank you so much, Jaime. Again, I think our theme song's about to start playing, isn't it?
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.
So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your rights. Come on, get up, stand up.
I'm Ian Masters, the host of Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org, returning to the KPFK airwaves Mondays through Thursdays at 5 p.m. and on Sundays at 11 a.m. to help your community radio station survive. Each day, Background Briefing looks into the important stories and issues in the news to provide an in-depth daily briefing with context, history, and insight from the best-informed guests closer to the scene who offer analysis and details often overlooked, especially now that the media owners are groveling to Trump, who craves the adulation he gets from Fox News. So if you want reality-based information to get through the next 4 years, tune in Mondays through Thursdays at 5 p.m. and on Sundays at 11 a.m. for your Background Briefing here on KPFK 90.7 FM.
As officials continue to inspect the burned areas, some fire evacuees have been able to return to the places where their homes once stood and have a chance to dig through the rubble. That includes Delise Kelly, whose grandmother was one of the some 25 people killed in total from the LA wildfires. Her Altadena cottage burned down, and the 95-year-old woman was unable to get out during the overnight evacuations.
It's heartbreaking.